I shouldn't make movies anymore. Should go to a lunatic asylum right away.
Teutonic, bombastic, just a bit crazy. It could only be Werner Herzog, the German filmmaker, whose prodigious output has charmed, bemused, and enthused audiences for decades. His memoir, Every Man for Himself and God Against All, is out now, and you can watch a film about his life, Radical Dreamer, which is on general release. To reflect on his achievements, I'm joined by Jeff Andrew, the BFI's programmer at large, and film critic Muriel Zagger. Muriel, when and how did you first encounter Herzog's work?
Well, I don't know how Herzogian it was, but I became aware of Werner Herzog through images, isolated images, and also the sort of free-floating titles of his films when I was a child in the 70s. And I remember being very fascinated and terrified at the idea of the enigma of Caspar Hauser and that what that might entail, and then Aguirre, the Wrath of God. They were such mysterious, loaded titles. And then I remember seeing the poster for Nosferatu with Klaus Kinski as the vampire. And I was a little bit preoccupied with vampires as a child. So it all fed into one thing, one sort of worrying and fascinating area of cinema. And it was only years and years later that I saw firstly Caspar Hauser and then Aguirre and then a lot of his other films. And Nosferatu, and so that they came to, and that they were more of an astonishment even than I could have expected.
Jeff, what about you?
Well, like so many filmmakers, I first had an encounter with Werner Herzog's work at the Art Cinema Cambridge when I was a student, and I saw The Enigma of Caspar Hauser on its initial run in 1975. There was nothing particularly Herzogian about that, apart from watching the film, of course, but some months later, I'd moved to London and was living near the Electric Cinema Club in Portobello Road, where they used to do double bill late shows at weekends. And I went one Friday night to revisit Caspar Hauser, but also to catch for the first time Aguirre, Wrath of God, which I really wanted to see. And it was great. And it really, there was plenty to talk about with my flatmate when we got back to our basement flat. So we sat up for about an hour chatting and then went to bed. And an hour later, I was woken up by some sort of sound, I suppose, to see a man standing in silhouette staring at me in the doorway. He was a burglar, and I wasn't sure about this, and I just sort of called out Frank to my flatmate, and the figure disappeared. And I thought, in retrospect, I thought that was a pretty Herzogian experience.
Yeah, life and arts merging, yeah. And dreams. I think Herzog claims not to dream. He can only remember two or three dreams in his entire life.
Herzog
and that his films are the dreams, his work is the dream.
But he claims that he only dreams about mundane things like eating a sandwich. I don't know if that can be quite true, but probably you could describe his films as lucid dreams.
Well, certainly to go back to Caspar Hauser, we have Caspar describing his dreams in it, where Herzog seems to be making use of some footage he'd shot earlier in the Sahara. And that was for a film which turned out to be Fata Morgana. And that is full of dreamlike imagery. He abandoned the story because he was so taken by what he saw, especially the mirages in the Sahara, and then took the footage back after travelling around for some weeks and edited it into a film which sort of makes sense.
And his life has been so sort of mythologised, but it's also been self-mythologised. I wonder if we could go back a bit and ask, where does he come from? Who is he? What are the bare brass tacks of Werner Herzog's life? What do we know for sure?
My father did not live with us. He left the family fairly soon after my birth, and I'm glad that I didn't grow up with a father, with a commander-in-chief somehow. It was anarchy in the best sense. No rules, we set our own rules. Assigned one loaf of bread for the week, and my mother would make with a knife marks or grooves for Monday, Tuesday. So, and we would always be hungry, and sometimes by Friday the bread was eaten and we would hang on her skirt and and would cry and ask for something to eat. And my mother, and it's terrible, for children it's okay, but for mothers it's terrible. She, one day I remember, she abruptly turned around to us and very calm and very controlled said to us, if I could cut it out of my ribs, I would cut it out of my ribs, but I cannot. So you will stay hungry until Monday.
Well, we know that he grew up in Bavaria, that his father was not really around much, that his mother was very important to him, as indeed were his brothers, one of whom still serves as his producer. We also know that he was an inveterate traveller. He famously walked from Munich to Paris in order to save the life of the film historian Lottie H. Eisner. He is an inveterate traveller, but you do wonder, was he thinking of how Johann Sebastian Bach had walked all the way to Lübeck to see his hero, Buxtehude? Herzog, I think, is very aware of being in a certain tradition or certain traditions of German culture, but at the same time denies being part of that because I think he likes to be thought of as a one-off, as indeed do most artists.
So I would agree with all that. A one-off and also maybe sort of fully formed. That's part of the self-mythologizing, but it also sounds about right that he was born a filmmaker, although there are no very precocious experiences. In fact, he comes to see films later when he's about 12 years old, I think. Probably that not that unusual for a child who grew up during the war in a very remote part of Germany. But then once he decides he's going to be a filmmaker, he just is one, you know, and then he needs a camera. And as in a fairy tale, the cameras, in a Jean Cocteau movie maybe, the cameras fly into his hands and that he steals his first camera from film school because that is only right and proper, which is very much his sort of morality. Maybe just to go back a little bit to his childhood and the mythical aspects of it. There's a story that he was born in Munich in 42, so really in the middle of the war, and then the house was bombed. His mother found him in his crib, covered in broken glass but unharmed. Mm. And then she took him, of course, she took him and his brothers to this remote valley in Bavaria, where
Sachrein,
where he experienced a sort of 18th century German fairy tale childhood, I suppose, very far away from health and safety. So, you know, a sort of swallows and Amazons childhood where they spent all their time in the woods with the animals, but also, I would say, adjacent to Lord of the Flies in that there was no adult supervision. So the boys made their own rules and Werner ended up stabbing one of his brothers twice, for example. So an anarchy there that's very troubling, but that is one of the things that feeds into his artistic temperament, the idea of wildness and how to corral it or channel it.
I wonder how interesting figures in his life almost collude in the mythologizing because there is some facts interwoven. So his mother said about Herzog as a child, and I quote, he's absolutely unable to explain anything. He knows, he sees, he understands, but he cannot explain. That is not his nature. Everything goes into him, and if it comes out transformed. So this is, she's actually talking about the boy, Werner, that she always saw would grow into this kind of exceptional human being. And Werner Herzog also says that his mother always thought that he was an exceptional human being, exceptional gifts. And it is, I think, a very German thing to see the artist as a gifted seer, almost as a repository of wisdom that is out of it himself in an inscrutable way.
And it's interesting you mentioned that things go into him and then emerge transformed. He made a documentary about Bayreuth called The Transformation of the World into Music. And when I had to give my first talk on Herzog a decade ago, I called the talk The Transformation of the World into Film, because that's what he does, really. He sort of is immensely curious about the world. And then he lets his imagination go to work and he transforms things so that everything we see and hear becomes Herzogian, for want of a better word.
And it's a prodigious output. I mean, he disdains the distinction between documentary and fiction, and he talks about he's not interested in the accountant's truth, the cinema verite tradition of trying to get down to the kind of narrow reality. It's more of an aestheticization of experience.
Yeah, I one thing that struck me forcefully when I saw Aguirre for the first time is how visually stunning and other it is and transporting, but also it's set in the 16th century, so these are conquistadors, Spanish conquistadors in Peru, are they, or Mexico? Monaco in the jungle.
I think at that time it was
Peru. It wasn't very well defined, perhaps. And it's obviously a historical drama, but there is, because of the way it's filmed, and I suspect the conditions of filming, there's an element of reportage. So it's almost as though, you know, we're talking about childhood. When you're a very small child and you see for the first time, as in my case, a film about Louis XIV, you think, if you're six or seven, you think, oh, they had cinema in those days and they filmed at Versailles. There is a strange sort of sliding like this, where you're watching Aguirre, it's all 16th century, yet it's a film, but because of the way you're really in there with all the conquistadors and their helpers and the Indians, you're almost pushing through them in a way that you would if you were doing war reportage.
Certainly, when you catch the opening shots of Aguirre and you see the people going on that perilously narrow path with huge drop between them, you think, oh, well, the conquistadors had to do this. But then you think, but so did the actors. And where have they got the cameras positioned on this perilous path, you know? And inevitably, with that film and certainly with Fitzcarraldo, they sort of become like documents of their own making. And that's true of quite a few of his films. It's interesting because he has made films with actors, which we therefore possibly call fiction features, but so many of those films are actually based on historical events or real characters, although Herzog's attitude to that reality is very much one of exploiting it and turning it around. Aguirre is supposedly based on the journal of a monk who was traveling with the conquistadors, but actually Herzog wrote it himself. And he's always doing that sort of thing. And he, you know, in Caspar Hauser, there's no evidence that Caspar was ever sort of exhibited in a circus. But it makes a good story. And he does regard himself as a storyteller, amongst other things.
And when he takes real-life historical figures, I'm thinking of Carlo Gesualdo, his documentary, I put in inverted commas,
a wonderful film.
In the studio here, is a brilliant film and gets close to the heart of the fascination that people have with this mad Renaissance composer, who's a murderer, was alleged to be a baby killer. He was terrifying, but his music has a kind of chromatic beauty that Werner himself talks about how he discovered Gesualdo when he was in his 20s. Mm. And he said it was this beam of light straight into his head that he couldn't understand how the centuries had fallen away. That vaunting aesthetic sensibility, that sense that anything is up for grabs, I think is something that people criticise about Herzog, but then it also is so central to the kind of aesthetic experiences he is interested in. Yeah.
He is curious about everything.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, he's interested in people going through extreme situations of one kind or another. It could be geographical extremes or historical extremes or just extreme experience, because he thinks they reveal themselves most then. But I think he likes thinking about people and think, what would it be like to be that person? It's a very empathetic approach, really, for better or worse in some cases.
Yes, I think that's a very good word, actually, empathy. Always think, I wonder how porous he is really and how recessed.
I don't think he gives a lot away, but I think he takes a lot in.
Yeah.
Well, empathy itself is a German term. It's from Enfühlung, which goes into English and gets recycled as empathy. And there's now a German word called Empathie, which is a bastardization of empathy. But it is actually a word rooted in German idealism.
So he's very resistant to psychoanalysis, psychiatry, all those very German, I mean, things that I tend to associate with German thought or history of thought, Herzog, and I think his therapy is to just create these fresh images. But having seen his last movie, Family Romance, LLC, which is a very good example of the blurring between documentary and fiction, so he's still operating in that way, grabbing hold of anything magpie-like, you know, anything strange and shiny, like in this case, an agency in Japan that provides rent-a-relative services. So you can rent a replacement father or husband or child, presumably, I don't know, for an event where your wedding day, for example. And this follows a man who is played by a man who actually works for such an agency as an actor, somebody who pretends to be somebody else. He plays the part of an actor who works for an agency like that, who poses as a 12-year-old girl's father, and she believes that he is indeed her father. So it opens all kinds of really vertiginous ethical avenues from the opening scene. As soon as you understand what's going on, and is left unresolved. But it's very Herzogian, I think, that sort of twist of documentary. So this is a real thing that exists in Japan and that obviously fulfills a need that is felt in society. But he tells a story then which is about authenticity, family, potentially robots replacing humans, you know, and what's acceptable ethically and what isn't. So he's still doing it. This is pretty much the way he continues to operate.
And he reads very widely. I think that's the tension with him, is that he's sometimes described as, I think, the lost son of German cinema, as a guy who has a curious relationship to his home country. And yet he's made quite a lot of films set in Germany and about Absolutely. And about German identity. His Meeting Gorbachev film from 2018, which I can't think of a better film about Mikhail Gorbachev or that captures the weird tragedy of the man. But it does so in a strangely sort of almost fictionalised way. This odd encounter is rooted around interviews between Herzog and Gorbachev, and then interviews with other people and archive footage. There's a strong fictionalisation to it, but it gets to the heart of Gorbachev, even despite all the kind of fripperies and the little things he does.
I mean, he's repeatedly said he doesn't really sort of distinguish between fiction and documentary. You know, those terms are meaningless to him, and indeed they are to many of the best filmmakers. Including Herzog's hero, the late Abbas Kiarostami, who made films which were quite often very hard to tell which bits were real and which were not. And that's, I think it's been there from the very beginning of his work. And it continues. He is, for somebody who's made a very varied body of work, it's also completely consistent in many respects. In that respect, he is definitely what people like to call an auteur.
In terms of his Germanness, you said lost son of German cinema, and that is, of course, exactly how he is identified by Lotti Eisner, who is very important historian of German cinema, but also significantly a concentration camp survivor herself. And what she sees in him when she first sees, I don't know if she first sees Aguirre or Kaspar Hauser, I can't remember
it
which.
It was Signs of Life.
It was Signs of Life. So the very first film that he made, she immediately tells Fritz Lang, it's all right, German cinema is not dead. The Nazis had destroyed it, but actually there is continuity, there is a new generation. And what was called the new German cinema, which is not a school of cinema particularly, but just a generation of younger filmmakers, some of them were very happy to tell stories about contemporary Germany, which was in itself quite a risky thing to do, you know. But with Herzog,
Fassbinder,
Schlondorf, Wim Wenders, also a peripatetic director, actually. But with Herzog, he was also the one in that group who had the courage to reconnect with Expressionism and Romanticism and to look backwards to the Germany of the past while, of course, completely transmogrifying
it. And while completely denying that he was doing that a lot of the time. He has sort of gone on record saying that, oh, people always ask me, you know, am I part of the Romantic tradition or the Expressionist tradition? Because those are the only two sort of movements that non-Germans know about in terms of German culture. And he denies that he's a romantic because he says, I don't romanticise nature. Well, I think he does, really. He may say it's indifferent and hostile, but he talks about nature so much and visualises it so much. And I think he is definitely linked to the German romantic tradition. It's a bit more difficult with expressionism because his films don't look at all expressionist for the most part. On the other hand, he does talk about wanting to find images which are appropriate to the character's inner landscapes or dreamscapes. Well, if that isn't expressionism, I don't know what is. So he is definitely working within a German tradition, and he's very much a product of that new German cinema, which wasn't a movement, it was a group of people. Most of the filmmakers were more explicitly political than Herzog, and I think he shares their not only distaste, but hatred of what the previous generations had done in Germany. And this probably explains why he has such a dark view of human progress and civilization. But at the same time, he's not just part of that movement or part of that generation. He is Werner Herzog as an individual. And I think, like most people, he can be understood within the context, but that's not the entire story.
Yes, he ranges within German culture to places which are probably a bit uncomfortable for us, like Georg Büchner. He talks about how he loves Friedrich Hölderlin. I mean, I can't think of many times people talk about their great love of Friedrich Hölderlin on Radio 4. You know, it's just slightly marginal figures. But as you'd expect from... Well, if you talk to an English person who's an educated Englishman, they'll have marginal loves and dislikes
he's
and loves about
other
things.
He's also attracted towards madness.
Exactly, yeah.
And sort of extreme situations, as you said. So not only... Well, not only, you know, things like Fitzcarraldo, where an opera fan who's a madman really wants to pull a steamboat all the way over a mountain. And actually, that is what the film is about. So again, it's the sort of making of while being a story. But also, he's very interested in the death penalty. And that is perhaps where his political sense has expressed itself most explicitly, maybe, in interviewing people on death row, interviewing the families of people, of victims' parents, and trying to get under the skin of that.
This is Into the Abyss, which is a phrase from Georg Büchner, which is, he made a film called Streusel, which is a novel by Georg Büchner. And his memoir, most recently, titled Jeder für sich und Gott gegen alle, Every Man for Himself and God Against
All. Which is the German title of The Enigma of Caspar.
The Enigma of Caspar Hauser.
So it's this merging, continual merging of life and art.
Yeah.
And I think with Herzog as well, something that people are attracted to about him is that he often talks about not having fear, being physically courageous. He then puts a lot of that courageousness actually on camera and performs it. But he is also at the same time being physically brave and taking risks for cinema. He talks about how he's a good soldier for cinema. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether, you know, he does walk the walk. He talks a lot about being fearless. But then you look at him, you know, filming Fitzcarraldo. There's an incredible documentary about the making of Fitzcarraldo called Burden of Dreams, directed by Les Blanc, which came out in 1981. And he does do things in that where you think, God, that is brave. God, you know, you're smoking a cigarette and standing on top of a boat which is going down some rapids, and his face is just a mask of sort of concentration, and there's just no fear. And you just think you are actually doing the thing you're saying, which is a rare thing in an artist, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I think this is sort of part of what has built up a sort of cult around him. Mm. I think people like to think of Herzog as crazy because there is this romantic idea that, you know, genius is always touched by madness. And having met Herzog a couple of times, he's not at all mad. He's perfectly sensible in many ways. He does do some odd things, but he's not mad. But he doesn't himself very strongly counteract suggestions that he could be mad. I think he's very aware of his image, of his brand.
He is. That's an absolutely fantastic illustration of the brand in action is that moment when he was being interviewed by, I think,
Mark Kermode,
BBC in Germany, and somebody took a shot at him with an air rifle.
It was in Los Angeles,
actually. In Los Angeles, okay. And
Which is, of course, where he lives.
Because he loves Los Angeles. I think he said the only thing wrong with Los Angeles is people don't speak the Bavarian dialect there, but otherwise it's perfect. Okay. So he is shot in the abdomen. He thought, I think, at the time that perhaps it was the camera that was exploding. I think that's really interesting that this is the first interpretation that he put on it. And, of course, the BBC crew are distraught and want to take him to hospital. And he says, in a hard-boiled sort of way, oh, this is not very significant, you know, it's fine, let's continue with the interview. So that's quite typical. So there is a sort of life shapes itself around him in a way that mimics what happens in his films, certainly.
I mean, one does have to wonder, what's this sort of setup?
Well, there is a rumour that it was, but I want to believe that it really happened. Because partly because we know that there are crazy people running around with guns in America. Well, it's not as if...
Mark Kermode vouches for it. I don't know if he's in on the story. But he says that he really didn't show any fear. He was just, you know...
Yeah, I mean, but you just see it. You
Mark
do see
is also somebody who's very aware of the Kermode brand. So, and I think this moment...
So many layers in this moment.
This moment didn't exactly hurt his own career either.
But I wonder, in terms of the madness, Jeff, what do you think? That you've interviewed him, he is hyper-sane, or certainly portrays himself as hyper-sane. And a lot of interviews I've read, he always says, I'm the only sane person in this crazy world. Could it be that the craziness that is part of the Herzog brand is actually embodied by Klaus Kinski? That what he's done is import a sort of id to his ego, you know, with this great
Who's Klaus Kinski?
So who is Klaus Kinski?
Well, I mean, Kinski was clearly a bit crazy, to say the least, and very volatile and unpleasant a lot of the time, as well as being a rather brilliant actor and an eccentric actor.
And they seem to have met quite early on in
they
Herzog's
did. I mean, you know, Kinski was quite well known before Herzog came along. He's actually in a Douglas Sirk film of the late 50s.
A remarkable-looking man.
Yeah. But I think when they made Aguirre, I mean, it was obviously a difficult shoot for so many people in so many ways, but I think, you know, their own ambitions coincided quite well, despite the conflicts between them. And certainly in a film like Wojciech, Kinski is wonderful. But I think all the sort of conflict and tensions between them has fed into the image of Herzog being a little crazy himself, partly because people wonder, why would you work with Klaus Kinski? Mm. You know, as I say, I don't think that Herzog is keen to brush aside thoughts that he might be touched by madness, because, as I say, you know, there is the possible association that he could be a genius.
Yes.
It's interesting you say that he's like the sort of double for Herzog. Herzog talks himself about how he has this extraordinary self-discipline, and he talks in his memoir about how the knife attack he inflicted on his brother, which you mentioned earlier, gave him a sort of rupture in his life where he suddenly, it was forced on him. He had to develop a rigid self-discipline with his emotions, that abyss inside him. He just had to shut it down. But then he's working with this also very Teutonic figure, shock of blonde hair. What's always remarkable to me is the footage of them working together in South America when they're shooting films about heroic figures in South America, is that these two figures shouting at each other in German about how the film was going badly or how it's going, however, and the whole set around them is just watching them, you know, people
from it's a performance.
People from the Amazon are just sort of looking at them going, and Werner Herzog himself says that one of the extras in the film offered to kill Klaus Kinski because he thought that Werner Herzog would like that. Again, how much of that is narrative? But it is a great story.
It's a great story. There is certainly a sense that, you know, to put it in context, a lot of directors over, you know, the years, the history of cinema, have sort of hitched their wagon to one particular actor or actress who was their sort of proxy. So, you know, François Truffaut and Jean-Pierre Léo, Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro.
People.
But often that is because these people get on well and it makes the work easier. Mm. And in the case of Herzog and Kinski, who met when Kinski was already in his mid-30s, an established actor and already quite unhinged. And Werner Herzog was only a young teenager. I think he was 13. They were lodging in the same boarding house. And so Herzog witnessed firsthand as a child the rages, the sort of rock star rages of Kinski, who would wreck, you know, a whole room, the furniture, all of that. So he knew what he was letting himself in for. He wanted that energy. And in a way, there's a sense when you hear those recordings of the rages of Kinski on the show, and Herzog's responses, which are hyper-reasonable, perhaps the better to inflame Kinski, actually. So, 9-9, Herr Kinski, in a very soft-spoken way. Kinski is almost like his violin, like a sort of possessed, demoniacal violin that Herzog is playing. That's the way it strikes me.
Perhaps it's important that he meets Kinski outside the context of acting. He just sees something in him, and that seems quite a theme in Herzog's films. He doesn't go to actors because the quality of their crafts per se. It's something he sees in them, and he also uses people who aren't actors at all. And I guess we can come to later people like Bruno S, who has his own curious story, you know. And even in films like Cave of Forgotten Dreams, his documentary. Again, I'm doing inverted commas in the studio. Documentary about cave paintings. He uses the scientists in the Chauvet Cave network who have explored the cave network. He uses them almost as actors in the film, as sort of extras in his own story. Yeah. And he talks about their stories as well, and it's all a bit curious. And I know it absolutely inflames people who are like serious anthropologists or serious prehistorian experts, because they look at that film and go, it's just Herzog telling a story. But that's not the point. He's a filmmaker. He's interested in images, in aestheticization of experience. He's not interested in what a scientist can do in a report. That's just not what he's for.
No, he takes something from them and then transforms it to his own purposes. It's interesting that really since Fitzcarraldo, his films with actors haven't actually mainly been very good. The documentaries have been much more interesting. And I think with only a few exceptions, he clearly isn't very good with professional actors. I think in Nosferatu, apart from Kinski, who is amazing as Dracula, both Bruno Ganz and Isabella Gianni are very good, but they're both being encouraged to act rather in the style of German silent cinema. So it's very stylized. And I think it's interesting to think about Herzog's relationship towards realism, because he is interested in some sort of reality, but it's his own reality and, you know, his own truth. It's a very subjective thing.
And a sort of ecstatic reality, isn't it? A reality that is
It's certainly
at a higher pitch.
It's certainly at a higher pitch
than everyday reality.
Yeah. Some of his films are very much about doom and gloom and the abyss and the void, so I'm not sure about ecstasy there, but they are very extreme. And in that, again, I think we can go back to romanticism. And
but also in terms of ecstasy, I mean, that may not be quite the right word, but I remember when I saw Fata Morgana. Mm. So this is a curious sort of documentary, as you said before, which started out as a science fiction project, I think?
Yes, it was meant to be about astronauts from the Andromeda nebula visiting Earth to make a film to take back as a report on humanity.
So there is something of that left in the feel of the film, but I remember, so the first part in particular, which is called Creation, and while the film is playing, Lotte Eisner is narrating the Mayan creation myth. Mm. And so it is like a lot of creation myths about the separation between earth and water. And there is some extraordinary footage of sort of pellucid sheets of water in the sand, or where it almost looks, because the image is moving in a certain way, as though water and earth are going to peel off from each other. So I certainly experienced a sort of trance watching the film. So that is perhaps what I meant in terms
of ecstatic truth. It is one of his strangest films and possibly his first masterpiece. And it's one of his most ironic. I mean, it's sort of, as you said, it starts with Creation and then we get the Golden Age and Paradise, I think, are the next two parts. And what we're seeing are some of the most, well, we're just seeing a lot of debris in the desert and dead animals and poverty and mad stuff. It's interesting there that he took the narration by Lotte Eisner. It's partly taken from a Mayan creation text, the Popol Vuh, but not all of it is, because quite a lot of the voiceover is also written by Werner Herzog, and he doesn't make any distinction between the two.
Yeah, I think it's also really thought-provoking in his films where he uses footage made by other people. Yeah. Like Grizzly Man's probably his most famous and extreme example. This is footage shot by someone called Timothy Treadwell, who lived with grizzly bears for years and years. And it's a fascinating film because it's cut through with Herzog interviewing people who'd met Treadwell in his experiences. It's also cut through with Herzog listening to recordings, particularly a recording of Treadwell dying, which he then passes to one of Treadwell's contemporaries and says, "You must never listen to this. This is too disturbing." But you watch Herzog listening to it.
Well, this is part of the... I mean, OK, he's obviously listening to it. He is a brave person, but he's also... It's part of the mythology again, isn't it? He's sort of making sure that we see that he's able to listen to things that other people shouldn't go anywhere near.
But also
makes him special.
Distinguish... curate and distinguish experience which is useless and doesn't communicate with experiences that do. Mm. And he ends the film with, to bring up that word ecstasy again, a series of images which he identifies as ecstatic images. Mm. And the whole film, I feel, is building up to the point where he says, the whole point about Treadwell, he was this maniacal, weird person, psychologically disturbed, in many ways pitiful figure who took enormous risks and actually was pretty appalling. But then Herzog, and he's so sceptical about Treadwell, he just sort of says, you know, he's completely deluded about his relationship with the bears. But then he says, but you've just got to look at the footage, the bear reality of the footage. Sorry, the bears, footage of the bears. And he says there is a kind of grace and beauty in the image. And you have this just shot of two bears fighting. Mm. But you feel like Herzog's made the viewer work quite hard to get there. And I think that's probably what that moment early on the film of listening to something which you don't get to hear is part of it saying you have to work hard for images that really matter. You have to go through the ringer a little bit. It's like blood from a stone. But when you get the image that, you know, that new image in an era of exhausted images, in an era that says we've run out of images, that, you know, it's hard, it's difficult.
In this respect, he's absolutely there with Wenders, who talks about the need for new images, fresh images, that overabundance of images in our lives. And, you know, Herzog is part of that tradition, I think. There are a number of filmmakers who think that way, and they're often amongst the most interesting filmmakers we have, because so many films are just full of clichéd images. I mean, if Herzog has any cliché, it's only that he is always going to be Werner Herzog, and nobody else could be that, thank heavens.
Do you think that's because, I mean, he talks often about his generation of being a very special generation, the German generation that grew up with some memory of the war, but beyond it. And he says, he talks about how they have a special responsibility and labour under a particular burden. And I wonder if that generation is passing away and how we don't have that sense of a special responsibility in terms of seeking images or redeeming things. Whereas someone born at that point in Germany is obviously highly conscious of what images can do to a culture, how can distort, how bad imagery can lead us into dark places.
Yeah, I mean, it's very worrying that we're seeing the world going the way it is at the moment. And perhaps too many people have forgotten about what happened then, or they've believed the people denying the reality of history. I mean, are we living in... I mean, I don't want to start sort of talking about the way the world is going too much, but I mean, the fact that so many movies in recent years, particularly in the sort of big industrial cultures, have been very much about escapism, have been about superheroes or, you know, I mean, and it's not just America, it's also China has gone. The wonderful films of the fourth and fifth and sixth generation Chinese filmmakers have been replaced by martial arts films a lot of the time. And, you know, Bollywood. It feels as if the people who make films in response to the world are getting fewer and fewer.
Whereas I think where he was really great, or of his generation, well, we can only be of our own generation, you know, we can be ourselves, we can be no other. But in his case, yes, that fatherless generation, I'm doing quotation marks in the studio, the post-war generation, where, as you said, there is a burden to sort of testify, perhaps, to reality, to the power of images, because there is this very recent past of Nazi propaganda films, for example, Leni Riefenstahl's movies, you know, that's German cinema of the Nazi era, and the horrors that were perpetrated. And I think one of Herzog's responses to this is fascination with the possibility of such a cultured nation as Germany falling into barbarism, including his own parents, because his mother was, I think, briefly a National Socialist, only briefly, so, you know, and not actively, I don't think, but nevertheless, it's quite something to live up to. And Romy Schneider, an Austrian actress, had to contend with the same sort of thing throughout her career. It's a heavy burden. But what one of the things he then seeks out is often images where there are no humans. Well, humanity has transgressed so badly that, like the Grizzly Man, who is a sort of deranged alter ego of Herzog as well, in a way, like Kinski, you seek a relationship with nature. He's deluded. The Grizzly Man, Treadwell, of course, ends up eaten by bears. Spoiler alert for people who haven't seen the film. But you know that's going to happen. This is not a Disney reality. But Herzog likes these images of the jungle, these very lingering shots of roiling waters, clouds, grasses, mountains, where there are no people and where animals roam free. And I am also very interested in the way that animals are handled. And I don't mean, you know, horses being mistreated during the certain shoots. It's possible that things were not as well regulated as they are now at the time. I'm thinking more of scenes like when Caspar Hauser is trying to teach a cat to walk in a way that is very affecting, because it mirrors some of the things that are being done to him in order to civilize him. And then also, I think it's in Fata Morgana that we see a man holding a turtle. And so the handling that turtle very directly. And then in Stroitzek, so the film with Bruno S., which we might return to, there's a scene where a doctor is talking to the protagonist and they are in the premature wing of the hospital and he's handling a premature baby who is tiny, tiny, again, in that very direct, sort of almost harsh way that seems to say humans are just animals. You know, we're all the same thing. And there is something terribly transgressive about humans placing themselves above. So in a way, I mean, he's not an ecologist exactly, but there's a hint of that, isn't there?
But then, let's forget that in Grizzly Man, he sort of looks into the eyes of the bear and he says he can see nothing that shares what we have. Yeah. There is nothing in this creature that has any of the qualities of a human being. And I think he's not sentimentalizing or even equating animals with humans. The thing about babies is I think he... Well, he'd certainly thought that Bruno S. was an innocent and a pure human being, and which is why he cast him as Caspar Hauser.
Just could we have a bit of autobiography of Bruno S.?
Well, Bruno, I think his mother was a prostitute who used to beat him, and then he spent a lot of his life in institutions, and then he became a sort of petty criminal. But he also, his own relationship to the German language was rather unusual. He wasn't particularly eloquent, and he had a painful life in many ways. But I think Herzog saw a documentary in which Bruno S. appeared, and decided this is the person I want to play Caspar. And actually, they got on very well. And I think, from what I can tell, it wasn't an exploitative relationship, really. You know, I think Herzog was quite keen to protect Bruno. And actually, then he went on to make Strotzek, which was very much based on Bruno in a way, not necessarily on his life, but inspired by his character and his sort of experiences.
Yeah, he's clearly really interested in those zones of experience where human beings blur with our traditional conceptions of beast and divinity. And many of his heroic characters are like that. They're driven by a kind of demonic force that brings them beyond the everyday. It's interesting you bring up animals, because that, I think, takes us to what I think is one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen, Land of Silence and Darkness.
This is greatest work, even now.
It's so extraordinary. It's just wonderful. And it does feature a scene with animals. It's about the deaf-blind community in Germany. The main character is someone called Finny Straubringer, who can speak because she only became deaf-blind as a late teenager. And he's a kind of Florence Nightingale of the deafblind community, of going round passionately advocating for their...
Having spent 3 decades in bed.
Yeah, extraordinary life, completely tragic. And she talks about... She can talk, which makes her so eloquent about their situation. Mm. It shows various gradations, as it were, of deafblind people. Some people who can only communicate simply through touching, these fluttering movements on each other's hands. Some who are completely removed from the world. There's a terrible example of a boy who'd been mistreated by his father or just brought up terribly with no support, who just is locked in to whatever reality he's in. He can barely communicate at all, apart from showing small signs of responding to music put up right up next to his ear. So he's completely locked in. Finny Straubringer is the centre of the film, but there are many characters in it who come into her orbit who are extraordinary, and she brings out the best in them and she communicates. And there's a really affecting scene where they go to a zoo and the camera kind of follows around this group of deafblind people in their meetings and kind of catch-ups, and they go to a zoo and they cradle a deer, and there's this moment of kind of extraordinary bliss that comes over Straubinger's face of sort of holding this animal. So intuitive with the animal as well. And the animal seems kind of calm. And then she says, oh, I'm sure it would like to go back to its mother. And it does go straight back to its mother, you know, pretty speedily. And she can't see it, but she understands what's going on. And I was just so struck by, I actually saw it quite recently, Land of Silence and Darkness. And it's the incredibly humane filmmaking. And I think Herzog, as we've talked about, is associated with the physically courageous, the crazy characters, the people who go over mountains, who want to build opera houses at the top of, in the Andes. But he's also someone who's made films about people who are...
Well, this is his most extreme film in a way, because it actually makes... I mean, this is most extremely empathetic, but it actually makes us as viewers wonder what it must be like to live in a world that is completely isolated, a world not of silence and darkness, really, because as Finney explains, there are all sorts of sounds all the time, and it's not darkness exactly, but they just can't see. But some of the people in that film, you do think, what does it actually mean to be alive? And what is consciousness? And it's a film that I think strikes at so many very basic philosophical questions. I always used to put it in my top 10 for the Sight and Sound best films of all time poll. And I've watched it 5-6 times, and I'm always in tears by the end. Not because it's at all maudlin or sentimental, it's not. But it is a film that... Recently I had to give a talk on Herzog, and I wanted to think, what sort of thinker is he really? And he's an intuitive thinker rather than an intellectual, although he takes on a lot. He reads a lot and thinks a lot. And there are elements of romanticism and elements of expressionism and whatever in his thought. But in the end, he is a humanist. And I think at his best in films like that, or Kaspar Hauser or Wojciech, you know, they are extraordinary films. And even Into the Abyss, the Death Row films, show his... He disagrees with capital punishment, and he says so in film, but he is a wonderful interviewer when he's talking to these people on death row, knowing what they've done. But he still, despite their terrible crimes and sometimes lack of remorse, it seems, he still treats them very much as... human equals.
I think, again, empathy without judgment. And getting back to Land of Silence, which I also loved, and I would say if you see one Werner Herzog film, it should be that one, at least to begin with. Even out of context, it's worth seeing cold, is lack of commiseration. So there is absolutely no sense of mawkishness about the film. And also, so he made these amazing, I would call, you know, Wild Blue Yonder films in the jungle, in the desert, and then maybe what I would call chamber films, or closer to chamber films, which are more about the internal. In the case of Land of Silence and Darkness, it's almost as though we, and with him, are feeling our way through a completely unknown continent of humanity, which is what it's like to be born in most cases, although not in the case of Finney, but in a lot of the cases of the people in the film, be born without sight, or very little sight, without hearing, or very little hearing. And she describes it in the film metaphorically as rivers, in terms of rivers and flowing water, which of course is a very Herzogian metaphor in and of itself. And then one scene I particularly enjoyed, because I think it's exactly what you described, Jeff, he makes us feel it, experience it, is when they go on a maiden flight, and at least one of the women, maybe all of the people on the plane, have never been on a plane before. So they're in this small plane.
It's a light aircraft, yeah.
They're flying amid the clouds, and they are having an animated conversation using the hand alphabet between themselves. So there is one helper who can see, a man who appears in a lot of the scenes, who can see and is describing what he sees to the lady he looks after. And then this lady communicates this to somebody else, and the whole conversation, which is obviously very animated and interesting, happens in a way that we cannot share.
We do see their happiness.
We see their happiness, and so we get the gist. And that is, of course, what it's like to be deaf and to be sitting with people who are talking, and you can see that they're happy or sad. You don't know what they're talking about. It's really immersing you into that experience. I thought that was just... I've never seen anything
like
it.
And the amazing thing is, of course, one of Herzog's obsessions is flight, and he's said this ridiculous thing that it's an injustice of nature that we don't have wings. I mean, a typical Herzogian statement, but he is fascinated in flying, and hence having been a skier, a ski jumper. But he paid for that flight for them so that they could go up, because it was Finney's birthday. And it's rather typical of Herzog, because it's an act of kindness, but it also serves his purposes as a filmmaker. The film, in the end, comes first.
And the thing that I find remarkable about Land of Silence and Darkness, and also that the title is taken from something a deafblind person says, which I think is a tribute to the kind of poetic elements that he films, and a tribute to them, is that he only shot 3 hours of footage, and it becomes 85 minutes. It's the most epigrammatic filmmaking ever.
No waste.
Think about the big budget films that get made, how much goes on the cutting room floor.
Yeah.
That is just 3 hours of him getting these images, just getting it out of the raw experience and putting it in cinema. It's just extraordinary. I think that kind of gets to the heart of Herzog. And that's why he often talks of himself almost like a seer. It is rare to have that ability to capture images, to be so good at capturing images. Out of 3 hours, 85 minutes is all usable, all some of the best cinema ever made. I think that's
But who knows what would have happened if he'd have made it during the digital era.
Yeah, exactly. But and also, I mean, the another point that returns to a theme we talked about earlier, about how hard he sometimes talks about getting images is he's talked about that. So the final shot of Land of Silence and Darkness is one of the most astonishing images I've ever seen in a cinema.
But don't tell people what it is.
I won't. But he talks about how if you watch the final scene in isolation, you would think nothing of it.
Yeah.
But in the context of an hour of sitting there absorbing images,
being
once you get it,
people.
Is ecstatic. It's like, you know, and the colour going on in Andrei Rublev, it's sort of like you've got to work for that ecstasy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done a lot of work, so you better work too.
Mm-hmm.
And I quite like that, you know, it's a demand on the audience that is very countercultural because we kind of want to think of things as immediate and immediate satisfaction. And certainly our literary culture is obsessed with immediacy and immediate communication. And whether things are immediately understandable is something writers often pride themselves by, almost like epigrammatic texts or tweets. But Herzog is completely in the opposite direction. He says, no, making aesthetic objects is hard work.
He's a very clear filmmaker, and at the start of the film, he tells you all about Finney's own experiences. We get that. And the great thing about Herzog is he's prepared to take his time over using long shots and showing things where not a great deal dramatic is happening. But he comes from a tradition. There are many filmmakers who do that. But he is very good at storytelling, and I think a film like The White Diamond is a great example of that. It's one of his most almost playful films in that the story keeps going all over the place. It ends up in a jungle, of course, but it starts off in Bedfordshire, of all places. And it takes in lots of different ideas and lots of different people. But the storytelling is always very clear. I think that's one of his great strengths. He knows how to shape a narrative. And even when things not very dramatic are happening, as in Land of Silence and Darkness, where we're just meeting people, having birthday parties and conversations and taking showers and whatever. But the dramatic strength that comes from the people themselves.
And I think the filmmaking always tries to, is a tribute to them.
Yeah.
The funny thing about Herzog, I always think, is it sort of goes out of my orbit for a couple of months, and then he just does something completely. He produces a new film about some completely random theme. The Japanese film you talked about was completely bizarre. And now he's got the memoir out, there's a film out, it's Radical Dreamer. I mean, he's 81 now. Do you think he's going to slow down? Is he going to keep on making films until he dies?
Well, he didn't come over for our recent retrospective. He's having a recuperatory year. I don't know, he's recuperating. I think he's had some health problems last year. And he is in his early 80s, and he has sort of slowed down a bit, although when you see him, he's clearly in pretty good shape.
Yeah.
And certainly mentally, you know, he's still very sharp and very Herzog.
Mm.
Who knows? Will he carry on as long as Clint Eastwood or even Manuel de Oliveira? It would be nice if he does.
Florian, the blind pianist in Herzog's 1974 film, The Enigma of Caspar Hauser. Paule, you've been watching Werner Herzog's films for 4 decades or so. Has your view of him changed in the light of the conversation between Jeff and Muriel? What are your reflections on Herzog's life and work?
Well, it's very interesting listening to that conversation because you do realise how much things have changed. I was thinking of the context in which Herzog was received in the UK, for example, which is now going back to the 1970s, and then his most celebrated film, I think the one that really broke through, was Aguirre, Wrath of God. And unlike your guests, I still think it's his greatest work. Thinking of that context, I think it's very difficult to realise just how radical German art was perceived as being during the 1970s and 1980s, and its ramifications are still with us. I mean, Herzog is still regarded as a really, really great filmmaker, a great individual filmmaker. And if we look at the music of that time as well, because he was part and parcel of a whole radical German reinvention of itself post-war that tapped into popular culture and high culture and melded the two. The most influential of that German reinvention, Renaissance even, one might call, is Kraftwerk, of course, who I would argue are the most influential pop group since the Beatles. There are others around there, groups like Cannes, Neu, Popol Vuh, who, of course, worked with Herzog, not least in that tremendous soundtrack to Aguirre, Wrath of God. All this was part and parcel of something that was seen as very fashionable, very radical, and has remained hugely influential, but was also quite disparate. You talk about what became known as the new German cinema, and how people like Margarete von Trotter, Alexander von Kluge, Herzog's contemporaries, and of course more famous figures, or more enduring figures perhaps, more well-known figures at least in the Anglophone world, like Wim Wenders, and I think the greatest of all of them, Rainer Werner Fassbinder, all melded together as part of this image of reinvention. I remember in particular a film that really encapsulated that period, a film called Germany in Autumn, which is where a number of the figures associated with the new German cinema collaborated together and produced their own excerpts, which were reflections on the Baader-Meinhof years, those really, really challenging years that threatened the very existence of the West German state as it was there. But I think also the way that we think about Herzog has changed. It was mentioned that Herzog, he's so strongly identified with Klaus Kinski. And I think there was a very important message there that Kinski probably was mad, whereas Herzog, the curator of his own image, was far from a lunatic. He was obviously engaged with madness. He was obsessed by madness. And I think we see that in all his films, from Wojciech to Aguirre, certainly. Fitzcarraldo, of course, which I argue actually is where he lost the plot as a traditional filmmaker. From then on, I think he becomes more of a documentary maker. In many ways, Fitzcarraldo is a documentary. And of course, Burden of Dreams is literally the documentary that comes from the making of Fitzcarraldo. But I think his period as a really, really great narrative filmmaker, if that's what you call it, is relatively short-lived. Then he follows his own obsessions and becomes more of a documentary filmmaker, which, of course, he always was to a certain extent.
Yes, I love Muriel's idea of the discipline, almost clinical discipline, of Werner Herzog as an artist has to have its counter-expression in the craziness and madness of Kinski. He is his shadow. That's part and parcel of the creativity at the same time.
Yeah, I think he is, and he is the curator of his own image. I mean, strangely, the person he reminds me of in contemporary German culture is Jürgen Klopp, the Liverpool manager, who also is this man who's plainly highly intelligent and brings very analytical skills to his job at the highest level, and yet presents this image as, you know, a crazy German guy. And it's a kind of type that a certain German of a certain generation wants to present to the world. But actually, it's very, very carefully curated image that's born of this reinvention of German culture, reinvented twice, of course, in West German culture after 1945, and then German culture more widely, this embrace of German culture that includes both East and West. And this is very important to see a culture, a brilliant culture, one of the great European cultures, if not one of the great world cultures, with deep, deep roots in the visual arts. We talk about Romanticism, Impressionism, Expressionism. They're all part of this incredible German culture. And cinema is absolutely central to that, because we forget now, in the dominance of Marvel films and Hollywood and everything else, that the really great pioneers of cinema were the German directors. And even within Hollywood, those who could translate themselves into Hollywood, like Billy Wilder, like Fritz Lang, like Ernst Lubitsch, by von Stroheim, it's always been part of this tradition that speaks to itself. What's interesting, I think, about Herzog is how he's always trying to escape Germany. It's the great difference between him and his peerless contemporary, Rainer Werner Fassbinder, is that Fassbinder looks directly into the heart of German culture, into what some might say is this kind of putrefying heart of West German culture during the 1970s, this deeply problematic culture. He does through a kind of lens of Hollywood melodrama, particularly the works of Douglas Sirk, of course, who Klaus Kinski made his Hollywood debut for long before he was associated with Herzog. Whereas Herzog himself always seems to look outside. He did have his engagement with German society, with German themes, shall we say, in Woyzeck, of course, and in The Enigma of Caspar Hauser and others. But I always think he was restless. He was a wanderer, almost in a kind of Wotan sort of way, a man who was, there is something kind of Wagnerian about Herzog never quite being at home anywhere, the outsider. The walk, of course, to Lotte Eisner is part of that mythology. It's very Germanic, the wanderer, but it's also seeking to escape that Germanness. And of course, what really matters in an artist, or what profoundly matters their reputation, is that they live a long while and are allowed to curate their own story. And because Herzog has lived to a great age, he's now in charge of his own narrative. Of course, that hasn't happened to Rainer Werner Fassbinder, although he has been the subject, in particular lately, of a brilliant series of essays by Ian Penman, who was one of those people, of course, who during the New Musical Express in the late 70s, early 80s, was the person who introduced the likes of Herzog and Fassbinder and the other new German cinema to a much wider audience. And it's worth remembering to people of a certain generation that Herzog's Strotzek is particularly associated with the suicide of Ian Curtis, the singer of Joy Division. That was the last film he watched on that fateful Saturday night before he hanged himself. So you really get this incredible relationship between popular culture in the UK and this new German cinema that I think has been rather forgotten. And that still has a real resonance for, shall I say, people of a certain generation.
I talked about it in the episode. The criticism of Herzog is that he doesn't look back because he dare not, because he has to be the wanderer and always looking for new images around the world. I do think he does engage with Germany later on in his career, but he does so through the lens of Europeanness and Catholicism. Mm. His documentary about Mikhail Gorbachev, yep, is about the future of Europe, which includes, for Herzog, and I think he's on record, of trying to discuss the status of Russia within European culture. And he talks about what Gorbachev meant for the reunification, mm, of Germany, how fragile that felt at the time. But that's going back to Germany almost round the back.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think you see that transformation in the way that we think of him now. He's become, I suppose, perhaps he always was, a Christian thinker, you know, a Christian artist. There is pity there. There's a great deal of pity. One might call it empathy. I know we discussed the word empathy, which has, of course, connotations that are particularly German, going back to the 19th and early 20th centuries. But there was a time, perhaps more honest time, when he was much more pagan in his, and much more pitiless. This is almost a reenactment of Nietzsche's criticism of Wagner here, of that return to Christianity. There's a pitilessness about Aguirre, Wrath of God. You know, that final fabulous scene when Aguirre is on the raft surrounded by these monkeys raging at the world, this pitiless world. There's a lot of difference to that to some of his documentaries where he shows huge empathy towards people. And I think this interest in Europeanness, what we might call Christendom, his interest in Pope Benedict, all this is reflective of, I think, of what he really is. But who knows what Herzog really is, because he is such a great curator of his image.
Yes, there are images in Aguirre which almost seem like they've been torn out of the fabric of the world. They've
Absolutely.
Been grasped and ripped out.
And I think
as
you
a kind
see
of,
that.
Yeah, as a kind of, you know, F you to the divine.
Well, you also see that in Wojciech as well, I think. Mm. You see it in those earlier masterpieces. And they remain masterpieces. I mean, they stand up very, very well.
And I think you're absolutely right. And we talked at length in the podcast about Herzog's films about disability, which, again, perhaps speak to us more directly.
Yes, I think they do. I think we find something like Aguirre a very, very difficult figure to sympathise with. I mean, we think of decolonisation. I mean, he is literally a person who is not going there to spread Christianity. He is not going there to spread the good news. He's not going there to bring civilization to the Americas. He's there to plunder it. And he's absolutely shameless about that fact. And he will risk all. And he doesn't even pity himself when that end is reached. There's something Nietzschean about that, this kind of Übermensch mentality that's there. And I think that may be Herzog just confronting this thing in the way that Fassbinder confronts West German culture. There's a fearlessness about it. There's a cold eye about the whole thing. But I'm not sure that's the natural Herzog that we've seen, the real Herzog. But as I say before, what is the real Herzog? We'll never know. All we have ultimately is the cinema and the carefully curated image.
Thanks to Jeff Andrew, Muriel Zagger and Paul Lay. You've been listening to EI Talks on Engelsberg Ideas. EI Talks is produced by Alistair Benn and Mary Jessel. The sound engineer is Gareth Jones. And until next time, thanks for listening.